From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, if you found yourself in tears while watching the trailer for the new Mr. Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor? Well, you're not alone, and director Morgan Neville has a theory as to why.
Those of us who grew up with him had a connection with him that predates almost anything else in our life. And there's something about spending time with him that asks us to revisit a part of ourselves we haven't visited in a very, very long time.
And you know the artist Christo, who wraps buildings in all sorts of materials. Today we meet an LA street artist who wraps buildings in balloons. All that coming right up.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. And Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We begin today with some soothing sounds of childhood. You may have guessed it already. That's the opening music to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. The beloved children's television program is now celebrating the 50th anniversary of its national launch. Fred Rogers created and hosted the series. He was also the writer, composer, puppeteer, and voice of the puppets in the show, from Daniel Tiger to King Friday the 13th. The earliest version of Mr. Rogers was produced in Canada and then later in Pittsburgh on public television station WQED before going national on PBS stations in 1968. In the new documentary Won't You Be My Neighbor, director Morgan Neville traces the show's unlikely path to success. As one of the producers of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood puts it in the film, if you take all the elements that make good television and do the exact opposite, you have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So what did make it work? Here's Morgan Neville.
I think it was because of him, you know, because of the trueness of his message and the way he was able to communicate with kids, that everything else was really secondary. And he created this really unique vision that was not only ahead of its time and apart from its time, but is unique in history. I mean, people are still not doing the things he was doing on his show.
Was part of the motivation for making the film kind of this exploration into the separation and overlap between the man and the character, and about who he was in private and who he was on television and how much of one mirrored the other? And was this guy for real, basically?
Well, I mean, that is the essential question. And there's actually this great book that he put out, a collection of letters he got and his responses to them. And it's one of my favorite things. He got more letters at one point than anybody in America, and he personally responded to every single letter. But the first letter in this book starts with, "Are you for real?" And I think that's kind of essentially the question we all have. Like, is this guy for real? Like, can he really be this character? You know, what is the difference between the man and the character? And we're so used now to seeing this huge divide between our TV heroes and the people who play them. So I'm here to report that he's the same person, you know, but not exactly the same. And in many ways, Fred Rogers, as opposed to Mr. Rogers, was this deep thinker. He was a Presbyterian minister. He had a graduate degree in childhood development. He was a seeker. He wanted to learn his whole life, and he wanted to minister to people. He spoke many languages. He was a pacifist vegetarian. I mean, there are many intriguing things about him. And so in many ways, I think that Fred Rogers is actually a better character than Mr. Rogers, because he's a more dimensional version of what you would want Mr. Rogers to be.
And he also recognized, I think, before a lot of people did, that there was something really noxious about what children were seeing on television, and that he recognized that there needed to be some sort of corrective alternative.
Yeah, I mean, he had this moment of kind of staggering insight when he came home from a college break, and this would have been 1949. His parents had gotten a television, and not many people had them at that point. And he had never seen it before. And on spring break, he was watching it and watching these shows where people were throwing pies in each other's faces and laughing. And he knew in that moment that this new device was going to change our society and that there would be generations of children raised by this new box, and that somebody had to look out for them. And in that moment, he told his parents he was going to change his major. He was going to basically take a new life course. And instead of becoming a minister immediately, he decided to move to New York and used his family's connections to get a job at NBC and worked at Rockefeller Center for several years to learn the ins and outs of television. And I think there's something about the timing of it that if Fred Rogers had been born, I think even 5 years sooner or later, the show never would have happened. It was the perfect synchronicity of, you know, the right man with the right medium at the right time.
I think a lot of people also forget just how revolutionary his show was in dealing with topics like death, divorce, violence, segregation. Here's a cut from a special episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that aired in primetime after the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy in June of 1968. It was just 2 months after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.
What does assassination mean? Have you heard that word a lot today?
Yes. And I didn't know what it meant.
Well, it means somebody getting killed in a sort of surprise way.
It's unbelievable what he's dealing with and how he's talking about such a serious issue. Was that something that he felt was almost part of his duty to children?
Without a doubt. I mean, that specific episode, which was a special episode that happened because Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated on a Wednesday night, and the funeral was going to be broadcast on Saturday morning nationally. And Mr. Rogers knew that children were going to be home and they were going to understand that something bad had happened. And so he said, I need to make a special, which he threw together and it aired that Friday night, the night before the funeral, for parents to understand how to talk to their kids about what had happened. And for him, that was something he forced on the network and forced people to do because he said, well, this is exactly why I'm here. And he did versions of that in the wake of numerous tragedies over decades. But he really felt like it was in those moments that he was at his best. And it was really when I was thinking about making this film and I went and I visited the archives, I'd heard about this episode, which hadn't been seen in years, and I had them put it up for me and I watched it. And at the end of watching that episode, I knew I had to make this film. It was just that clear to me that all the dimension, everything I wanted to say was embodied in that episode.
KBCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy-eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Now let's get back to my conversation with filmmaker Morgan Neville about his documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor? The film is about Fred Rogers, the creator and host of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Rogers was an ordained Presbyterian priest, and in some ways he saw his show as a kind of ministry. The film also delves into Mr. Rogers' childhood in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and how it informed the show that he created. Here's Morgan Neville, the director of Won't You Be My Neighbor?
His family was wealthy and they owned a factory in the town. And in the wake of the Lindbergh kidnapping, his parents kept him kind of under latchkey. And on top of that, he had a number of illnesses and he was overweight. And so he kind of grew up by himself in his bedroom, playing piano and playing with puppets. And he remained incredibly in touch with everything he thought and felt as a child. So I think he went back to his own childhood again and again and again to figure out what kids needed to hear. And Daniel Tiger really became the purest embodiment of who Fred was as a child and what Fred's fears were. And even more than that, I think about this a lot, that, you know, Daniel Striped Tiger was a tame tiger. He talked a lot about taming one's emotions. And I think Fred understood that children acted out not out of anger, but out of the underlying cause, which was fear. So I think Fred always tried to figure out what made kids fearful and how to help them understand those things in kind of age-appropriate ways.
There's also this song that Mr. Rogers wrote that I think is as much, you know, a statement of his theology as it is about his belief about the world. It's called It's You I Like. And it seems to get at so much of what he's about and what he is kind of, in a way, preaching. There's an episode where he sings it with a boy who's quadriplegic who's using a wheelchair. His name is Jeff Erlinger. Let's listen to this.
It's you I like. It's not the things you wear. It's not the way you do your hair. But it's you I like. The way you are right now. The way down deep inside you. Not the things that I do. Not your fancy chair. That's just beside you.
I mean, Fred said that clip was his favorite clip of all 33 years of shows. And I know why, because in a way, it's Fred at his best, which is looking at something difficult and making us understand how to normalize it. You know, something like having handicapped children on your TV show, he did it numerous times, not just that one time. And to this day, how many handicapped kids do you see on TV? You know, very few to none. So for him, I think that's really kind of why he was put on television, why he was put on Earth, was for moments like that.
One of the things that I had forgotten is that he tried to make an adult version of his show called Old Friends, New Friends. What was the motivation behind that, and how did it turn out?
I think he thought he could broaden the audience and investigate other things that were interesting to him. And the show Old Friends, New Friends, he did two seasons of it. It's actually a fascinating series. And he did episodes with Milton Berle and Hoagie Carmichael and, you know, a neurosurgeon and all kinds of, he went to a jail. But the show was a failure. And I've thought a lot about why that is. And part of it is, I think kids are really, really good at saying exactly what they are thinking or expressing exactly how they're feeling. And I think as we grow up, we learn to mask our feelings and hide our intentions. That's part of what being an adult is, for better or worse. And Fred had no tolerance for any of that. Fred always spoke to you very directly with laser focus and would cut through whatever shields you had up. And I think a lot of adults just were uncomfortable with it. I think they just couldn't handle somebody being that emotionally direct in that time as he was.
One of the things that I found kind of odd is that there was a strain of criticism about Mr. Rogers and about Fred Rogers, which was kind of tied to entitlement and, I guess, in its kind of simplest form, the idea that he would say that every kid is special just for being who they are was somehow really uncomfortable for a lot of people to grasp and understand and appreciate.
Yeah, there was a certain amount of kind of op-ed speak that basically had a very simplistic critique, you know, that millennials were now an entitled generation because Mr. Rogers told them they were special. And I think where they all miss the point is that it was never about expressing that everybody was entitled to worth. It was about protecting kids from feeling worthless and understanding that we all have some purpose here, that we all should respect ourselves enough. And that was really it. It was looking out for the people who felt powerless and for children that felt that they had nobody else looking out for them. And that's something he finally defined in the last speech he ever gave, his last commencement address.
It's not the honors and the prizes and the fancy outsides of life which ultimately nourish our souls. It's the knowing that we can be trusted, that we never have to fear the truth, that the bedrock of our lives from which we make our choices is very good stuff.
It's very difficult to watch your documentary and not be moved to tears. A lot of people in the office who watched it did the same thing. You knew exactly what they were watching when they started dabbing at their cheeks. And I think it even happened when the trailer dropped. So what is it about Mr. Rogers that moves people to tears? What do you think is behind that?
I wish I could bottle it. I don't, you know, it's, I mean, I have thought a lot about it. And the film still gets me emotional You know, even as we were finishing the film and watching it back again and again, we kept getting emotional watching it. And I think part of it is that those of us who grew up with him had a connection with him that predates almost anything else in our life. You know, next to our family members, it's probably the oldest relationship we have. And there's something about spending time with him that asks us to revisit a part of ourselves we haven't visited in a very, very long time. Our own, I guess you could call it inner child. But there's something about the directness with which he speaks. Like I said, he had that laser focus in his way of cutting through all the adult filters and shields and getting right to the core of what it is. And the experience to me of watching the film is finally you have to kind of succumb to his directness. You kind of have to give in and say, okay, I'm willing to be emotionally open as you are. You know, I'm willing to be vulnerable, because Fred was incredibly vulnerable always. And I think you finally have to kind of meet him on those grounds, because he would have it no other way. He always made you come to him.
The film ends with this almost existential question of what Fred would be doing in today's world. It's almost impossible to kind of figure what his message would be. But I think you and I can agree that he might be even more needed today than he was when his show was on the air. And I wonder if there is any kind of alternative now to Mr. Rogers. I think about, you know, what young children see on television. I also think about who we can turn to if there's a mass shooting or a natural disaster. And it's a very short list. And there doesn't seem to be any place where you can go where you can get the attention and guidance and love that Mr. Rogers gave so many people when he was on television.
Yeah, I don't think there is new Mr. Rogers. And I've thought a lot about this, too, that, you know, if you think about the legacy of what he did, spending, you know, decades imprinting a little bit of his worldview and trying to impart a sense of kindness to the millions of people that watched him, I think that's where his legacy is. I mean, I really feel like whatever we can activate in ourselves that he left in us, whatever kindness we can remember, whatever neighborliness we can remember, that's what we should think about in terms of the legacy of Mr. Rogers. Because not only do I not see the person, I don't see the room for that kind of figure, which I think is tragic. And I think it's part of why people are so happy to see Mr. Rogers come back. I mean, that gives me hope, the fact that so many people are pining for this kind of kindness, and not, as Fred would say, not in a Pollyanna-ish way, but in an honest goodness, real kindness, for the sake of kindness, remembering that that's as important as everything else. And I feel like our culture keeps sliding the other way, and we have to remember that kindness is the thing that allows us to all live together, to have a neighborhood together. So I think if we can't remember those things, we're going to be in big trouble.
Morgan Neville is the director of the documentary Won't You Be My Neighbor. Morgan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, John.
The balloons of artist Jahan Zentrali have covered an Echo Park market and a clinic on Sunset Boulevard and engulfed downtown's Grand Central Market. They've been on the exterior of the Broad Museum and taken over the pool of the Roosevelt Hotel. The balloons have shown up in San Francisco's Mission District and also the New York City Ballet. If you haven't seen Zentrali's work in person, it's likely made its way into your Instagram feed. But who is she, and why does she do it? Frame contributor Joanna Clay gets a behind-the-scenes look at the mysterious founder of Geronimo Balloons.
Jahan Zentrali isn't your typical balloon artist.
Truth is, I've actually never made a balloon animal.
No, instead of one balloon, she works with thousands. You might have driven by her installations. Big, round balloons of all sizes, snaking around the edges of buildings or curling over awnings. Like that one time, thousands of blush-toned balloons billowed out of a neighborhood store in Echo Park.
It's funny because on the internet, people really hated it because it looked like it was an STD, they said, and it was this fleshy pink nude color.
Jahan is a street artist covering buildings, not with spray paint, but with balloons.
So LA is my canvas, and it's where I feel the most inspired and ignited. And I love working like on the streets here. So I often will like kind of cruise the town at night, and I'd see like, that building doesn't look like it's being very well monitored. that looks like a building I could scale.
It means waking up at the crack of dawn, blowing up thousands of balloons and sculpting them into formation, all while most Angelenos are still asleep. After working for hours, her team heads home for some shut-eye. But then, often, Jahan will come by the next day. She's seen it all.
Mostly it's selfies. And then it's someone who like is riding by on their bike and they decide to like rip off some of it, and I see them down the street and they just got a trail of it. And then it's like sometimes people licking it or putting their bum on it. I've literally seen someone like rub their bare rear end on the balloons and then walk away. And I'm like, no one will realize that that just happened. I am the only one.
The other day, I made a trip with Jahan to look at some materials.
Head northeast on South San Pedro Street. In a quarter mile, turn right onto
there
East 9th Street.
It's a power supply store in downtown LA's Pinata District.
Flamingo aisle. Let's walk through the pinatas.
After a brief walk through the store, we head to the front counter, where she chats with the workers.
So we're in the back behind the registers, behind like the offices, in this little kind of alley of balloons. Like they keep these really special back here.
It's a wall lined with boxes and boxes full of balloons.
It has like a 36-inch balloon inside.
Geronimo Balloons started with a single balloon, a 36-inch one, to be specific.
Hey, do you know if you have the balloon tassels? Like 2010, I get a big balloon and I start adding tassels to it. I call them frills. Now in 2018, you can buy.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
Oh, that's perfect. Thank you. That's
essentially a DIY kit to make a balloon with tassels on it.
I invented it. I made it up as a concept. Like this didn't exist to hang off of a balloon.
Early on, this is what she was known for. These elaborate big balloons with tassels hanging down. She delivered clusters of them to celebrity parties, like for Kanye and Taylor Swift.
And so there becomes this kind of sense of currency over having this very opulent balloon design and then their friends wanting to also have it. And so it was this trend that I was constantly being referred to someone's more famous and more rich friend. And so,
but she started to think maybe this wasn't the way she wanted her business to go.
But for me, it wasn't interesting doing parties any longer. I wanted a different challenge, and I also wanted to create something that wasn't so exclusive to individuals.
So in 2015, a few years into her business, Cadillac approaches her to do a commercial. She said she was down, but with one caveat.
And I told them that I wasn't interested in doing kind of the normal thing and that I wanted to create something that was living outside of my studio.
That's when she did her first public installation, the work she's so known for now. It was a few doors down from her studio at that neighborhood store mentioned earlier.
We made this commercial and the photos from it went fairly viral. Sia, who lives up the street, drove by and she posted a photo on Instagram, and she remember her telling us how inspirational it was. So that was kind of the start of it.
Now, she juggles commissions with high-profile clients with guerrilla ballooning, which means looking for local spots to attack with her creativity. And that might be South LA, where she just moved.
I love this church so much right here. I think it's so beautiful.
Can we step outside real quick?
On the way back from the party store, we drive around our neighborhood, and we stop in front of what looks to be an abandoned church.
This one just looks so regal, and I would love to get onto the roof of this building. Like, it's a really tall church, it's not short. You know when, like, there's spy movies, like 007, and then they have, like, this harpoon that essentially, like, cast like this anchor onto like the top of a building, and then like, you know, 007 will like rappel or, you know, ascend essentially into the sky. That's how I think I'm going to be able to get onto this building.
So be aware, Los Angeles. You see someone scaling a building, holding balloons, you're not hallucinating. For The Frame, this is Joanna Clay.
And that is our show for today. Remember to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.